Hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for Rural Grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. My name is Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for today's call. Today is the second call of our two-part series on failure to protect. The topic for today's session is moving beyond failure to protect, and I'm happy to welcome back our trainers from last week, Olga Trujillo, Joyce Yadlosky, and Catherine Munster. Hi, you three.
Hi.
Hey.
Hello.
We're all here? Good.
Good. Cool.
Glad to hear your voices since we had that music before we started.
Yeah,
right.
Glad we're all together. Before you all get started, I want to just briefly explain how these calls work. We hope that all of the programs on the line have been able to download the electronic binder for this series, but if there's any of you who haven't already done so, it's available on our website. We encourage you to go and download the binder if you can, because Kathy and Joyce have included a number of helpful resources. So I think you'll be glad that you did. The operator, Stephanie, will have our phone lines muted throughout the whole session today so that you don't have to worry about muting your own phone. When Olga is ready for questions and comments in a little bit here, Stephanie will tell you, explain how to get into the question queue. So that should happen shortly. And finally, we record these sessions and we make them available online for listening to and downloading from our website. So if you go to the Rural TA portion of our page, our website page, you'll see the event recording section, and you'll be able to access the calls that way. So Olga and Joyce and Kathy, that's all I have. So if you want to go ahead and get us started with our session, everyone would be glad to hear you.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Liz. For those who weren't with us last week, I thought it'd be good if we went ahead and introduced ourselves again and tell folks a little bit about ourselves. And then, so I'll start off, and then Kathy, you and Joyce. And then I'll go ahead and kind of frame the issue of, frame our call today. And then I think it'd be good, just to make sure everybody's on the same page, we do just a little synopsis of last week and then go from there. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, so I'm Olga Trujillo. I'm a director of programs at Casa de Esperanza. I'm a technical assistance partner with Praxis International, and that's how I'm participating today. And I'm also a consultant that has worked on issues of the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child abuse as a consultant or as in other ways, in other roles, for the past 13, 14 years. And I have worked with communities around the country either as a funder or as a consultant, looking at how they're putting their collaborations between domestic violence and child welfare and the courts, how they're doing those collaborations, and ways that they can enhance those. I've also been involved, and I didn't talk about this last week, but so much of what West Virginia has done always reminds me of this process. I've also been involved for the past few years with Praxis's safety and accountability audit. And the safety and accountability audit is a institutional ethnography look at how agencies and other government institutions or nonprofit organizations, how they organize the way people do their work. And the reason that I raise that is because so much of what West Virginia has done is change the way that people are organized to do their work and think about their work. And they've done that in change of policies, change of laws, and we'll hear a little bit more about that today, but I'll go ahead and let Kathy and Joyce introduce themselves.
I am Joyce Yadlosky, and I'm the Protective Services Coordinator with the West Virginia Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And I come from a background of working as a domestic violence advocate, beginning that work in South Carolina, actually, in 1988, started working with a shelter-based domestic violence program and a family court program in South Carolina, and then did some work as a home health social worker and as a foster care social worker, so I kind of went over to the child protection side of things for a little bit in North Carolina. And then in 1999, moved back to my home state of West Virginia, where I started coordinating on a statewide level the issues relating to the co-occurrence of domestic violence and child victimization. And at the Coalition, I do coordinate a statewide domestic violence child victimization study and policy work group and sit on many state collaboratives that deal with the co-occurrence, including the court improvement programs, the Children's Justice Task Force Citizen Review Panel, and have worked extensively on a multidisciplinary approach to systemic as well as practical applications of best practice, those kinds of things in West Virginia.
And my name is Catherine Munster, and I'm an attorney here in West Virginia. I've been working on the child welfare side of things for over 30 years now in West Virginia, starting out doing child protective services for what was the Department of Welfare in those days. In this state, it's now called the DHHR, Department of Health and Human Resources. Eventually became so thoroughly disenchanted with some of the way the systems folks were handling these issues, I went to law school. And after I graduated from law school, I have represented abused and neglected children in child protection proceedings, civil child protection proceedings is what we call them in this state, for over 20 years. I also became very active in doing systems change work on the child welfare side, became involved with Children's Justice Task Force and some other collaboratives, and ended up with the State Supreme Court's Court Improvement Board, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a bit. In that capacity, I wrote the rules of child abuse and neglect that is now used in West Virginia, state court rules approved by the State Supreme Court, and became very much involved in looking at collaboratives, wrote some of the first statutes in West Virginia on multidisciplinary teamwork in child welfare, both investigation and treatment. And always looking for the opportunity to collaborate further, became acquainted with Diane Reese, who was with the West Virginia Coalition on Domestic Violence, and she invited me to participate in the work group that Joyce is just talking about, and so we began collaborating together, bringing our various collaborative hats to the same table. And as a result of that work, have led to some of the changes that hopefully will be, that we talked about at some length last time and maybe a little bit more today.
Great. Okay, so last week, I think it was on Thursday actually, we had the first of these calls, and we heard a little bit, we heard actually quite a bit about how West Virginia kind of came to this place where they felt that the term and the response to domestic violence by child welfare agencies using failure to protect was not working. And I'm really simplifying that. So Kathy, you and Joy should jump in if I'm mischaracterizing anything there. But they came to a place where the identifying the adult victim as not protecting the child and then finding her at fault for failing to protect the child in a domestic violence case or in a domestic violence and child abuse case really wasn't getting at the heart of the issue. And so they were able to bring the right people to the table, both at the tops of the agencies and then those who were directly involved with doing this work at the
what we call kind of a direct service or at the street level, and come up with a completely different approach to these cases. Now, as they explained last week, they had not had the term failure to protect on the books for quite some time. So if I'm right, Kathy, you guys had gotten rid of the term failure to protect within the child welfare code a while back. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that actually West Virginia's definition of a parent in this situation is fairly typical. My guess is that folks on the phone, if they go back and actually read their child welfare code, might find that the term failure to protect doesn't occur in their code either.
Oh, it's just how it... Okay, got it.
Okay, I think it really is just a term that people started using, and it is replete, was at the time we started this, throughout DHHR policy.
Oh.
All the written policy and all that kind of stuff, it was there. But when you actually read the code, it wasn't literally there.
Okay, so they were doing it was within their application of the law that they used failure to protect.
Right.
Okay, so then in the process of kind of looking at this and thinking about this and seeing how this was affecting non-offending parents who were victims of domestic violence and their children and that relationship, you guys really changed the way the law approached this and the policies and procedures within child welfare in your state viewed that non-offending parent and what her role was.
Right.
Okay, so we heard about how they kind of came about this, and really it's just, I just have to say this again, it's really very creative, the approach that they've taken. And I haven't seen anything like this in any other state. Now, I've done a lot of work around the country around these issues, and it is possible that some other states have done something similar to this, but I haven't seen it. So we talked last time about why they went this route and an overview of how they did it, like how they got those people to the table, the difficult conversations that they had to have, how they had to, and then really kind of crafting something that would be responsive to what they were seeing in terms of how women who were victims of domestic violence were being treated and how they might change that. So, and we heard some of the challenges that they faced in trying to change those statutes and some of the policies and procedures. So our call today is going to focus more around how they're implementing these changes in West Virginia and some of the challenges that they're facing. And then we're going to talk a little bit about, because in their implementation and some of the challenges, we're going to talk a little bit, and this where I'll jump in a little bit more, is around, so when you see this, how they've structured this, how do you assess the needs of mothers and their children, and what is the impact of trauma, and talk a little bit about what kinds of services would help. And I'm going to do that from a survivor perspective of having been in a home where there was domestic violence perpetrated by my father against my mother, and I was being physically and sexually abused by my father. So that's what we've got in store for us today. And we have 45 minutes to do that, right? No. An hour and 15 minutes left to do that. And we're going to stop periodically. And I'm thinking, Kathy and Joyce, if it's okay with you, I might stop a little more often today just to make sure that we're getting questions as they're coming up. Does that sound all right?
Sure.
Okay. Okay, so you guys want to take it with the implementation?
Sure. This is Kathy. I'm going to talk for just a few minutes about the implementation process. Let me quickly add just a couple of summary points for those of you who may not have been here last time. the significant change of attitude that I think underlies much of what Olga was talking about that occurred here in West Virginia was recognizing that the department's previous policy of walking away if there was a so-called protecting parent and not providing any assistance was across the board the way they dealt with things, not just in domestic violence, but in child sexual abuse cases, any kind. And so by definition, if CPS was involved to provide services, then a parent had to be non-protecting, because if there was a protecting parent, they didn't get involved. And I think it's this kind of attitude that actually underlies much of the way child welfare is handled across the country. And it's one of the big assumptions that we decided we needed to challenge. Essentially, as we went into more detail last time, we've had a variety of different collaboratives that have been working for years and better understanding one another's points of view. Olga, I think last time asked, you know, well, what extra ingredients are there that kind of mixes this up? I've been given that a lot of thought. I think one of the things that occurred here is that there was active recruitment of folks outside of their comfort zone. In other words, child welfare willing to come talk with DV, DV willing to talk with CPS, but also inviting some additional folks to the table. Zealous child advocates who are attorneys, zealous domestic violence advocates who are attorneys. We really tried to cross-fertilize with independents, folks that are not salaried from a particular agency, but who come at it answerable only to their individual constituency, to try to leaven the bread a little bit. All of this has been going on for several years, and one of the things that that leads to is the opportunity to seize an opportunity when you see it. And that's really what happened in West Virginia. I got appointed by the Court Improvement Board to chair something called the Overlap Subcommittee. And I'm not going to go into all the detail about that because it's only particular to West Virginia, but each of you will have opportunities in your state once you're ready to see them. In our case, it was the Court Improvement Board wanted us to come up with a report about how many child abuse allegations were happening in custody cases between parents and grandparents and that sort of thing, versus coming up with the state being involved in a protection proceeding, and how do you sort all that out? It was in that, over the period of 2 years, that as a group, and we brought in DV, CPS, the court, lawyers, all those different folks, that we came up with a collaboration that changed the Supreme Court's rules on how to handle abuse and neglect cases in these situations, draft legislation that added the battered parent adjudication and some of those other things that we talked about last time, completely rewrote Department of Human Services policy on this issue, and extensive training agreements, cross-training agreements among the agencies. This took us a couple of years to put together, and a lot of shuttle diplomacy, I must say, on my part. I spent a lot of time on the road. But the result of this was that within a very sudden, it must have seemed almost magical to those on the outside, our state Supreme Court adopted the overlap report calling for these changes and these agreements in its entirety, promulgated the proposed rules on an emergency basis so that they were in effect even during the comment period. The Department of Human Services decided to rewrite its policy and accepted the help to write that policy of representatives of Court Improvement Board and the Domestic Violence Coalition, which they'd never done before. The Domestic Violence Coalition took on the objective of spearheading the legislation to make sure that it could get through the legislature. And then we set an effective date for all of this of July 1, by which time we would train every judge, every magistrate, every CPS worker, every guardian ad litem, all the lawyers, all of the different folks involved in the system within the 6 months prior to July 1, so that when it all went into effect, everybody was going to be on the same page, and we did.
Wow.
That took a huge commitment. I can't tell you what kind of a commitment that takes from the Department of Human Services. First, we had to rewrite all their policy in time to train everybody, and of course, it was staggered, so some of this happened through the fall. But we were very, very pleased to have trained all of the judges and the lawyers and most of the CPS and certainly all the supervisors before all of this went into effect. The result of that were rules changes that allowed, as we talked about last time, the possibility of co-petitioning, which allows a parent to petition with the Department of Human Services against the batterer or against the abuser. And this co-petitioning, by the way, is not just for domestic violence cases. This changed the attitudes and policy of DHHR across the board. It meant that, say, domestic violence isn't involved in this case at all. It's a straight-out child sexual abuse case. Mom did not know. The child tells mom. Mom wants to protect. But what she's supposed to do, I mean, any prosecutor will tell you that a child sexual abuse case, this is one of the difficult, most difficult cases there is to prove. She's supposed to go down by herself to get a protective order. She's supposed to go prove this in a custody case without a lawyer. This is not working, regardless of whether or not there's domestic violence. And so now the Department of Human Services will still step in to assist mom in filing a co-petition in a child protection case so that the abuser's rights can be terminated and she can still get child support and all of those things. So this was a radical, a sea change in DHHR policy and approach across the board, and of course it came out of the recognitions that we had come to in working on the co-occurrence with domestic violence and child welfare. But as a result of those implementation efforts, we got the rules changed, the coalition was successful after 3 years of prior work to getting the battered parent adjudication legislation passed. We got the DHHR policy rewritten, eradicating their reference to failure to protect in its entirety. And with these training agreements, not only did the initial training in that preliminary period, but also have ongoing work on policy changes and training, which Joyce is going to talk about.
So let me just, before Joyce, before you go, can I just, there's something that you said, Kathy, that we talked about after the call last week. And that, Joyce, you said a couple times, I just want to make sure everyone's hearing. Because what happens in a lot of cases is exactly like you said, that if the parent is protecting the child, then CPS, child welfare, doesn't do anything further with the case. They'll close the case out. And then the mother may be then seeking a divorce, and it comes up in a child custody case. And then it's easy, like what we see a lot around the country is when mothers are bringing up child abuse claims in custody, it's looked at much differently than it would be in dependency court or juvenile court. It's looked at oftentimes as parental alienation or strategy to try to get custody, to win that custody case, and they don't have any of the backup from child welfare to do it. So we see cases around the country where someone who is abusing the child will ultimately get custody over the child because there wasn't any kind of substantiation or any follow-up done by child welfare, finding that that person was actually abusing that child because the other parent was protecting. So I want to just make sure, I don't know if I made that any clearer or not. I might have just made it way more confusing. But I wanted to make sure that people noted that West Virginia's effort here changes that, like, that they actually will go in and do that investigation and have that finding.
Right, and I just want to make it clear, too, that even though the department in the past would say that they're not opening a case or not substantiating it because the parent was protecting, that's not the message that the family court, the custody judge, got. They just got that the department isn't opening a case. So there's an assumption that they're not opening it because child abuse didn't occur.
Right.
And that's not actually why they wouldn't open the case. They agreed child abuse occurred, but they had a protecting parent, so there was no need for them to intervene. But and there was a difference. And so this what we're doing now is making that distinction. And when child abuse does occur, then there's now a process to move forward with that with the abusing parent without harming the non-abusing parent or finding them to be at fault.
So just this piece of what you guys have done, just that piece alone, would make a big difference around the country in terms of the custody cases that people are bringing forward.
And let me just add one other thing to this too, Olga, was that this is one of the big hooks then that we were able to use for involving CPS collaboration, because you've got people who are seriously invested in child protection and child safety, and here was a whole arena in which children were still being harmed, and boy, they got real interested at that point, because then they could suddenly see how it was that children could be hurt, and they were abrogating their responsibility to protect those children by not partnering with a parent who is trying to protect. And so they really got part of the buy-in was saying, gee, here's another way I can really help protect children.
Yeah, so that's a good strategy for people to use who want to try to do this kind of thing in their own community.
Right.
Cool. Okay, so Joyce, sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay. I was talking about the training efforts, and I want to say, too, just to add a little bit to what Kathy had said about the collaborative effort to train everyone initially, that we all had training agreements. And just a piece of that, too, which to me was another amazing, this is just, I was really amazed at the collaboration and the agreements that we came to. It was the best that I had seen and worked with. And one of the other agreements was that not only do we agree to train by a certain period of time and to train all of our own people, but we looked at each other's curricula and invited each other to attend the training so that we made sure we were consistent in our training. We participated with each other in the development of policy and curricula, which was unheard of prior to that. So it wasn't just the department allowing the coalition to come in and help with policy, but also the curricula, the courts, everyone, we shared that. However, the first round of training was pretty big training. It was extensive, and there was a lot of information that needed to be trained. So we trained on basic concepts, of which the ones that we're making reference to for victims of domestic violence was really only a piece of the training that they got, because there were some other changes that took place regarding some administrative processes that hadn't been there before. So when these trainings happened, people were ingesting a lot of information. So the first round was basically informing people of a new concept, and for some it was turning the whole approach on its head. So we had to have continuing training. So what we have done there to keep the concepts ongoing is that our coalition has a contract with the department to provide two rounds of training. The first one is a basic training, so all new workers, all new child welfare workers, are mandated to receive a one day of basic domestic violence training, and that curriculum is co-developed by our coalition and the Division of Training, DHHR Division of Training, and it's co-facilitated by the two of us, and it's trained to both child welfare workers and domestic violence advocates. So there's a partnership in the development, the training, and in the audience. So everyone's first look at domestic violence is through this basic training. Then after, what we've just implemented recently is what we were finding is that a day to understand basic concepts really wasn't enough, because we couldn't even talk about co-petitioning, better parent adjudication. We were just getting at what are the dynamics of domestic violence. So we have now instituted a second day of training that will happen once new workers have had all of their initial training and have started carrying a caseload, but prior to their first year of service. So within the first year, they'll have a second in-service training that gets at really practical applications of some of these ideas. And so that curriculum looks at the definition of domestic violence in the context of power and control, and kind of separating out violence that might occur in other ways other than in the context of power and control. How to look at one of the key points for co-petitioning and better parent adjudication is that the parent really isn't at fault. And one of the concepts for understanding that is the concepts of condoning violence, or as our code said, intentionally, knowingly allowing violence. And that is, even though we haven't said failure to protect in any of that language, that notion kind of creeps in. in those areas. So we really had to get at that. And actually, Olga, you've helped us out with that because we use your video. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's an excellent video. And there's a segment there that talks about how trauma victims frequently use accommodation and disassociation to actually, as a way of protecting themselves, and as a way of dealing with the trauma that they have suffered, and how if you take those behaviors, while they're understood from a mental health perspective, when you plug them into the child abuse and neglect system, it looks very much like condoning the violence. And so we use all of this video, and we train on that, and we talk about condoning violence and how that isn't knowingly, intentionally knowingly allowing the violence. And that.
Condoning is, but accommodating isn't.
Right. And so we make those distinctions. And then we talk also in the training about how victims of domestic violence might also not just condone the violence, but they may sometimes actively abuse and neglect. The statistics show that sometimes victims of domestic violence do abuse and neglect their children, and so how do we handle those cases? And we take it from an approach of holding them accountable for any abuse and neglect that they have perpetrated on the children, while at the same time protecting them as an adult victim of domestic violence. And then we also have to look at working with batterers and how do we exactly hold them accountable in a child protection system? How do we, what are some things that we can do to work with batterers? So that's an ongoing training that we just piloted this year, and the department will continue to provide that on an ongoing basis. We also developed some training tools. We did a couple of surveys and developed what we call a frequently asked question tool. So with the questions that people have about co-petitioning, because even though we have these massive training efforts, we're not able to get at everyone all the time. So we at least have these tools that have the most frequent questions available with the answers to them that, again, we share across disciplines. The court uses them, the DHHR uses them, we use them with domestic violence advocacy. And we have one also that we just developed that summarizes, in particular, co-petitioning and batter parent adjudication. And we still have ongoing collaboratives. The Domestic Violence Child Victimization Work Group that I coordinate, we keep an eye on how things are going. We have people coming in quarterly and talk about how things are going in their area. We tried a listserv for a while where people could post concerns on listservs. People didn't want to post concerns that way. There weren't very many, much traffic there. But they do bring them to the meetings, and we still have the overlap committee that Catherine referred to where we're still looking from the Court Improvement Board's perspective at the changes to make sure we're keeping some statistics and we're looking at whether they're being implemented effectively and what our training needs are there as well.
Okay, so let's stop there and see, Joyce, is that an okay stopping point?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, and see if folks have questions. So, Stephanie, can we open up the lines or can you check and see if there are comments or questions?
At this time, if you do have a question or comment, please press the number 1 on your phone. Be sure to press the number 1 only once. If you press it more than once, you will remove yourself from the question queue. And at this time, there are no questions.
Okay. Well, okay, so I have a question for you, Joyce. Okay. So how's that training going?
Well, we piloted in two locations in the state, and actually it went really well. We had some people who came in. Some of the people had already heard about it, and they were wanting more information. I had a few challenges. There were a couple of people who were not on board with co-petitioning. Most people who haven't had the training on it yet are not on board initially. And so I had a couple people who were not on board who did some open challenges in the training and then left. One of them, as a matter of fact, said, "This was an excellent training. I think we need to offer it to the prosecutors." So they were very open to it. They were very open, particularly to the section on accommodation, although many child welfare workers still had some struggles with, okay, I understand the concept, but how do I get that information? How do I know? We have Olga's video, and she was able to tell us that information, but victims aren't at a place to give that information when they are in the crisis. And so how do we determine that? What are some things that we can do? And when one of the ways we ease that up is to let particularly child welfare know that they of course always needed to err on the side of protecting the child, and that all of our provisions are such that if they're in an emergency, imminent danger situation, situation, and they have not determined whether or not the parent is at fault, whether there's accommodating going on, all these things that take time to determine, that it's okay to go ahead and file a petition with both parents at fault, because later on in the process, when you've had some time to investigate, you can switch it around. And in the other way, if you find that the parent, you think that the parent is not at fault and you've co-petitioned, and then you find that the parent has actively abused, then you can switch it back around too. So there are safe modes throughout the process so that when people are needing to move quickly and they don't have a lot of information, that things can be changed. And I think that that was a difficult part for some people. And some of the details in how to talk with someone about co-petitioning, what language do you put on the petition, all of those kinds of things were very well received because people were not getting those kinds of that kind of information in trainings they had before.
That's great. Were the trainings all mandated?
The basic domestic violence training is mandated for child welfare workers. It's optional for domestic violence advocates, but they tend to send their new workers and actually some seasoned workers there as well so that they can offer some collaborative opportunities. The in-service is not yet mandated. It is optional and highly encouraged by the department. I think that the struggle there is some funding. And to mandate someone, you have to assure that you're going to fund the training for everyone. And I think that might be a sticking point there. But the department is fully behind it, and all of their trainers came to the training so that they could be trained and continue to implement the training.
And it's not just DHHR also, because there are other collaboratives that are interested in the training that gets it more broadly spread as well. So, for instance, the Children's Justice Task Force, which is funded by federal monies and is available, as far as I know, in every state. It usually comes through the DHHR, but it's required to be multidisciplinary, and they do a massive statewide training, sometimes more than one, every year in West Virginia, and so we're invited, for instance, this time to do a whole seminar on Beyond Failure to Protect, which allowed us to bring the same information to other social workers, educators, lawyers, just the it's designed to be cross-training, and it is. So you have all the different folks from different disciplines that come. The Court Improvement Board also continues to provide training every year, and in the past has had a co-occurrence of domestic violence training that Joyce and I have been able to collaborate on in presenting to, again, cross-disciplinary lawyers, judges, and social workers, mental health, and educators as well. So this is an area of real interest around the state, and so there are several venues in which we're able to bring this. And we never seem to lack for folks who want to attend because, of course, there's turnover in this area.
Right.
Of practice, and also as people start using it, they develop new and more sophisticated questions, and so they want more information.
Right. So I don't mean to be dense. I just want to make sure that everybody understands what you're doing. So that first level training that you do is really kind of what is domestic violence, and how do you respond to it, and what resources are out there. Is that right, Joyce?
Yeah, that's correct. And we do get into the definitions issue. And one of the we go do some case studies, and one of the case studies that we do is an example of co-petitioning. So we introduce the idea there. But for the most part, it is dynamics, how children are impacted, how adult victims are impacted, and really hits hard on whose responsibility for harming the child is all of this, and with direction to look at the batterer as causing the harm, and so that any solutions are going to be working with the batterer, do some exercises on who do we frequently have do all of the stuff in the child welfare system, and it's the victim. How much power does the victim have versus what power they have as
right.
a state, and how much power a batterer has, those kinds of dynamics.
That's great. Okay, so that's the first level, right?
Yes. And that is mandated.
Okay.
For child welfare workers.
Okay, so then you get to the second level, and you're talking about kind of the implementation
of this new approach. Is that right?
Yes. That's the second level with child welfare workers. And then
okay.
the cross-training that Catherine was referring to is more implementation as well.
Okay. So then, and in that situation, you're talking about, you're going more in detail about, like, what accommodation might be and how that might look like condoning. But you go through the different options that they have and how they might use it. Is that correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we have a new training tool that talks exactly about all of the options that are available now. It kind of outlines them so that they can see very clearly that there are more options than there used to be. We're pretty big on charts and tools, training tools. As a matter of fact, how we got the battered parent adjudication through the legislators, we had a brochure that developed, this is the old way, and we had a chart, and this is the new way. We had a little star, and it's a new and more options. And so we're pretty good at helping visual learners with what the concepts are, and we do that in that curriculum.
Okay, and the chart that you have of the different options is attached as part of the handouts for this call. Is that right?
Right, yes.
Okay. Okay, cool. So then the questions that you guys are getting now, as after you've done these levels of training, like, are people coming back trying this and then saying, we don't know when this is happening, we can't tell? Is that what's coming up?
Yeah, let me just say, this is Kathy again. Similar to what Joyce is talking about, there is a similar kind of process on the legal side, because the Court Improvement Board, through our law school as well, offers basic training on child abuse and neglect, and tries to include in some of that some of these concepts of co-petitioning and battered parent adjudication and that kind of thing, so that people can see how, from the child welfare side, how all this works, including the lawyers and those folks who are so intimately involved in the process, so they get it. And then we also do the more advanced training, like what we were just talking about with the implementation places like Children's Justice Task Force, and also our Prosecuting Attorneys Institute is interested in having us address this for prosecuting attorneys, which is a group we'll talk about later under challenges.
Yeah.
But in any event, this then happens in more than just the DHHR. It happens involved with all of the different stakeholders as broadly as we can make it. And what we are getting more now is questions about, well, I tried it, and this is what happened to me. Or, gee, I'm having this problem here. What can I do to solve this problem? So it gets to be another level of conversation.
Wow, that's great. Okay, so I'm going to just check one more time to see if anyone has any comments or questions. And then after that, we'll go to the challenges. Does that sound okay with you guys?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, once again, if you do have a question or comment, please press the number 1 on your phone at this time. And we do actually have a caller from Poposa Springs, Colorado. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I am still trying to wrap my head around the implementation part, like the first step. Is that getting your state coalition, your domestic violence coalition involved, to start taking this on the legislative level, or is there a step prior to that before you get your state coalition involved?
Joyce, do you want to start on?
Yeah, I would say getting the state coalition involved, not at the legislative level to start with. I would say just getting the people around the table and providing education. The legislation happened eventually with our state, but it never would have happened if we didn't bring everybody together and start getting them on the same page and providing the education. We did that for a few years. I mean, we started this in 1999. So this was not a fast process, and a lot of it happened because we provided education. We had a grant, we had some money, we brought in national experts, and we had educational forums, and they were across discipline. We didn't just have DV advocates coming in and talking, we had everyone. And so that would be the first step that I would recommend, is to bring people to the table and start learning about each other's process. And educating about each other's process and really getting people to be on the same page. And then you can start doing an audit of your system. We didn't use the process that Praxis has because we were actually doing this work before they put that process out.
Right.
We might have saved a year or two.
I don't know. I think you guys
so I would recommend that as well. But we were able to get through our own audit candidly because we were open and were educated about each other's systems.
And if I can just add to that, my guess is that your state legislatures are very similar by nature to West Virginia's, and that is that legislators tend to be reluctant to pass legislation that is highly controversial when there is no unanimity among the stakeholders as to what that legislation should look like. So it was very important in West Virginia before this legislation was presented to the legislature by the coalition that we already had signed on to it all of the major stakeholders. So we knew that the child welfare agencies were going to support it. We knew that the private provider community was going to support it. We knew that DV was going to support it because we had already had them at the table and helping to develop it. And that's what allowed our legislature to say, well, gee, nobody seems to think this is a bad idea, so it must be okay. Even so, we had, you know, some of the usual hurdles one faces with trying to get legislation passed without somebody else's bright idea pasted onto it. But it would not have been able to go forward but for the years of development. And I would also caution you that the legislation, some of which I think you may have, could not stand alone. It came as part of a package deal that the stakeholders had agreed to, including the rules changes that allowed for co-petitioning and the policy changes, which are hugely important in all of this, plus all of the training agreements that we've been talking about. All of this came as a package deal through the collaboration under the Court Improvement Board, so as part of that overlap committee. So it was a variety of different collaboratives working together.
And I don't think our coalition would have gone forward with battered parent adjudication or the changing of the definition of child abuse to include domestic violence if we didn't also have the policy supporting the adult victim and the option of co-petitioning, because it could be dangerous to just implement a piece of the package.
Right. And that's a really good point, Joyce. And let me see if I can also add my two cents here. I think that you start with whoever will listen and is willing to work with you. And I think in what West Virginia has done, you have something that you can take to people and say, will this work in our community? And if you can't, because different states are structured differently,
right,
in terms of where the power is around child welfare, you may not have to go on a state level to make changes, but I would start with where you have support, and then bring in whoever else you can to make sure that, like, you have everyone who is involved in that process on board. And at least what you have after, now that West Virginia's done all this work, is something to look at and say, okay, so now will this work with our state? Like, are our state laws so different from theirs that we would have to, you know, add a lot more, or, you know, to really kind of take a good look at, you can bring in an example of how you might change things, which can start the dialogue. Like, there's a possibility to start the dialogue and go from there. And then the other thing I just want to mention that's unique about West Virginia is that, and Joyce, correct me if I'm wrong, what I remember when I was there last is that your coalition is, it's a small state and everybody knows who to go to around domestic violence policy. So your coalition has a really good reputation. It works really well with other partners, with other agencies, with the courts, and the legislature knows that. So having a coalition that has that kind of reputation is, you're going to get a lot more done with the coalition that way. Is that your sense of your coalition?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of groundwork had been laid before I even started this collaborative in 1999, where the coalition did have it had a good reputation. And we are a small state. I mean, compared, some of you, you have more people in your one of your cities or counties than we have in our whole state. So that certainly has been an advantage. But yeah, we did do that. The collaborative approach has always been our approach, not just with child victimization, but with any of the work that we do.
So, and then there's other states that I know that have equally strong coalitions, that have that kind of reputation, that are smaller states, that whenever anything around domestic violence or sexual assault, if it's a dual coalition, the people go directly to the coalition to find out, okay, so what's your take on this? What should we do on this? And in those states, for sure, you know, bring your coalition in as early as possible, because they are going to have a lot of power. In the larger states, it really does kind of depend on whether your coalition, you know, does have that kind of power. Because in the larger states, it could have just as much power, or it could be that the coalition hasn't established itself, because there's lots of other big programs that people can go to, that legislatures can go to. So just to kind of keep that in mind as you're thinking how to move this forward. Is that fair to say, Joyce and Kathy?
Yes, I agree.
Okay. So are there any other comments or questions?
Yes, we do have a caller from Rock Springs, Wyoming. Your line is open.
Okay, so do you have a question or a comment for us?
We don't. I'm not sure how our line opened up.
Ah, somebody hit that button. Okay, so it's nice to know that you guys are there, though.
Okay, and we do have a caller from Elko, Nevada. Your line is open.
Okay.
Yes, I was wondering, do you have an accredited video and training materials that are available for us to try and get on board here?
Any of the materials that we have, I'd be happy to send to you, and you can use them in whatever way you would like to. The two curricula that we just talked about, I can send that to you. All of the handouts, trainings, all of those things, if you would like them. I think my email address is posted somewhere. Is that correct, Olga?
You know, I'm not sure. Liz,
it's not.
Joyce. Okay. Joyce, no. do you want to give it to everybody?
Okay, it's pretty easy. It's Joyce, J-O-Y-C-E, at wvcadv.org. And if you'll email me, I'll be happy to send all of the materials in an electronic version that you can manipulate. The handouts that you got are in Adobe so that you can open them. But if you would like to take, for example, the PowerPoint and make some changes to adapt it to your state, just let me know. And I can send it to you in a way that you can make changes to it.
Okay, so, and I'm just going to repeat that email address because, anyway, I'm always, you know, worried about people being understood. So it's Joyce at WV for West Virginia, C-A, right?
Yes.
For Coalition Against DV, Domestic Violence, .org. Just want to make sure. Okay. Other questions or comments?
Thanks.
At this time, there are no additional, actually. Excuse me, we do have another caller, and that comes from Topeka, Kansas. Your line is open.
Hello, ladies. My question is, how did you get over I call them CFS workers or Child Protective Service workers, how did you get over or help them get over the we're neutral, we're not taking sides, because I was looking at your co-petition stuff, which I think is great and would love to see us going towards some of that. But very often our workers on the child welfare side are, you know, they stick to the we're neutral, we're not going to do that. And I guess I just want some suggestions on how to overcome that.
And can I also add in there that if it's not child protection that's doing that, sometimes it's the attorneys that are doing that.
Absolutely.
The judges that are doing it.
Right.
So Joyce or Kathy?
Well, I'll start, and then Kathy, you might have something to add. One of the first steps before we start to talk about co-petitioning or anything, after we provided education to ourselves, is when we started the, and this was actually part of the Federal Review Program Improvement Plan, which was another avenue for us to get stuff in. We failed the Federal Review, and so one of the areas we failed in was domestic violence, and so we needed domestic violence training. So that was our end for domestic violence training. Training is so key. And part of the training that we did, when we developed the training, our training says had addressed that issue. It said that adult victims, not neutral, victims, the parents aren't equal. The power isn't equal. We were talking about another victim, and we equated the adult victim with the experiences that child welfare knew to be there for child victims. And so they understood it from the perspective of the child. And when we did training to help them see that the adult victim was going through many of the same things that they understood child victims to go through, and that it wasn't neutral territory, then that helped make a change. And actually, because of the training at that time didn't match the policy. The policy didn't say that. So instead of adapting the training to the policy, we adapted the policy to the training. And that was one of the first changes that we made. And as one worker said, the policy states we have to treat adult victims like victims too. And that was kind of like the first seed change that we made.
That's fabulous. I think that, this is Kathy, that this is almost a good segue into one, at least, of the major challenges that we face when we start talking about implementing these things. Because being a small state, it seemed better for us to make sure that all of the policy and law and rules and procedures were changed to allow people to act in this new way. But then you still got to convince them to go ahead and act in a new way. And that really does mean changing the culture. And so when you take this on, you recognize that you got to be in it for the long haul, because if you're talking about changing a culture, you're talking about long term. And one of the things that we recognized in doing some of our training, for instance, is that people change from positions of strength. They feel, if you can take them from where they're comfortable to this new terrain, then they're more likely to come with you. So one of the things we tried to focus on is building on what they knew, building on what they thought they were comfortable with. And so in some of the trainings I do, for instance, then we just take it out of the domestic violence field and talk about child sexual assault. So, to answer your question about co-petitioning, how do you convince them not to be neutral? Well, I'm an old war horse in child protection, and I remember the days 30 years ago when people did not believe that child sexual abuse happened, where they thought, yep, that can't be true, that's just so terrible, that can't be happening, that can't be true, so they were inclined not to believe victims. And because of what we now know in terms of accommodation, children would sometimes use that defense mechanism. All too often, the horrible defense mantra of, oh, she's the one who initiated, she's the one who enjoyed it, she's the one who started it, particularly if you were dealing with like a 10-year-old girl who had been so sexualized that she looked much older. And so nowadays, and at least in West Virginia, and so if it's in West Virginia, it must be elsewhere, they recognize that those are old mythologies, and no child welfare worker today in West Virginia would tell you never believe a victim because child sexual abuse doesn't happen. No judge would say that, although I've had judges say it to me 30 years ago. So you take them from child sexual abuse, which they know. They know that the times change. They know that they learn to believe victims. They learn to recognize accommodation. Nobody blames a 4-year-old boy who has participated in oral sex for being a participant in oral sex. I mean, they don't blame the victim in that context anymore. And they're comfortable with that notion. They're also aware that it's a change from where we were 10 years ago. So when Joyce and I say domestic violence is today where sexual abuse was 10 years ago, they can make that bridge. So when I go in the field, for instance, and I ask how many of you are now using co-petitioning, one of our last conferences, we had a whole row of people in the back who raised their hands, and they said, you know, what we're starting with to try to train our prosecutors is in child sexual abuse cases. because nobody's neutral in a child sexual abuse case.
Right.
Nobody's expected to be neutral anymore. And so their prosecutor understands that and is willing to partner with a parent who's trying to protect in a child sexual abuse case, because they can see how being able to terminate parental rights is a hugely important feature. In West Virginia, you can terminate parental rights and still enforce child support. So this is a great solution for women in that situation, and nobody expects it to be neutral. Now, once they get that under their belts and they feel comfortable with that concept, then they can apply it to domestic violence, recognizing the exact same mechanisms that had existed in the child sexual abuse cases. So one of the ways we've tried to respond to that challenge in implementation is building on what they know to take them a little bit further.
Uh-huh. It seems to me, too, that the fact that the two of you will do this, and that you have people who have worked in child welfare and have worked in domestic violence, it seems to me that you come at it understanding their job better.
Oh, Olga, I could not agree with you more on that. I think it has been really, really important feature of certainly the cross-disciplinary training that we have done, that Joyce and I do it together. Because Joyce can say, this is where I'm coming from, and I can stand up and say, this is where I'm coming from. And then they can watch us collaborate.
Right.
So kind of model some of this stuff, as well as feeling understood.
Right. Exactly. So that's a big issue for getting people to listen to you, much less than to try to change the way that they're thinking about something.
Mm-hmm.
Were there other challenges to implementation?
Oh, my, yes. One of the big challenges is what happens when you don't get everybody at the table. And we really did try. But, you know, there are some times that you've got to go forward even without everybody there. And one of the populations that I personally think we did not adequately address was the prosecuting attorneys. And as a result, we have more resistance, I think, from that quarter. So when we get together with some of our trainings, one of the things we hear from DHHR social workers is, my prosecutor won't file a co-petition. So how do you, you know, get inroads there? And we have just continued to work on that. And one of the things that we've done is managed to talk through the Court Improvement Board training to a prosecuting attorney who has been resistant to co-petitioning, and you know, you just try to embrace that. So we ended up going to lunch together and having a chat, and eventually she decided that she was part of what we call in West Virginia the Prosecutors Institute, which is sort of a group of all the prosecutors. And so we now have an invitation to present on co-petitioning and to do an actual training at the Prosecutors Institute training in January.
Wow.
And so this is our first opportunity to try to speak to prosecutors. In the meantime, we have gotten invitations to speak by their office staff, so we've talked to their secretaries and we've talked to their victim assistance people, which I think also has kind of filtered up to the prosecutors that maybe they need to have a conversation with us. So that's an area of challenge. If you don't include everybody, you can expect there's going to be resistance from them, and you're going to have to deal with them eventually. And if we could have found a way to embrace our prosecutors earlier in this process, I think that would have been helpful to us. I think we would not have as much resistance there as we still do. The other thing is that as I think about challenges, you really are asking people to, well, as Joyce just said, stand their worldview on their head. I mean, this is a radical change in child welfare, and it's not easy on domestic violence advocates. Many of them are suspicious. They've had bad experiences with CPS. They don't see any reason why they ought to trust these folks. And so you have some mutual suspicion and some old ways of looking at things. These are worldviews, and you're asking people to make a big leap. And part of what we try to do in that, not only in terms of our implementation, but also in what brought us to the ideas that we had, was helping people deal with the fact that we simply cannot live with the old dichotomies anymore. I mean, it's always an either or. It's either you're protecting or you're not protecting. And if, under the old school way of looking at things, if you're protecting, we don't have anything to do with you if we're CPS. But if you're, and so by definition, if we are working with you, you must be non-protecting, because we have this either or. And I think persistently in our thinking and in the training we're trying to do, we challenge people to refuse to accept that. There's got to be a third alternative. There's got to be. It can't be just protecting or non-protecting. And so, of course, when you actually look at the real world, that's not the way it is. Real human beings try to protect and fail sometimes. They try to do their best and don't always succeed sometimes. But it's not a black or white, either or situation. And so what we tried to come up with was, okay, if it's not non-protecting or protecting, how about partnering in assisting protection, a jointly held responsibility as a third alternative?
Wow, that's amazing, Kathy. That's
and,
really
well,
creative.
Let me give you another example. I know another dichotomy that always comes up in CPS, and we talked about this briefly last week, and that is, do you leave the child in the home or do you remove them?
Right.
Either or. Well, for a child, that's not acceptable. And if you truly are a child advocate, if you really care about how children feel, then you need to come up, we need to come up, with a third alternative to that. Because if all there is in the world is living with violence or being removed from the only home you've ever known, then this world is a place that treats little children real mean. We need a third alternative, and so we started talking about, okay, how about removing batterers from the home? Let's start building in restraining orders and those kinds of things. If you've got to do a temporary separation and you're looking at reunification, then let's talk about reunifying with a portion of the family, not a whole family, if it's too dangerous. So looking for third alternatives and holding ourselves to that challenge, but also asking people in the field to always be looking for that third alternative. And to my real happiness, I find that most DV advocates and most CPS workers really welcome the opportunity to look for a third way because they've been frustrated by the old dichotomies.
Yeah, that's great. Joyce, did you have anything else that you wanted to add about the challenges?
Just one little challenge that demonstrates the practical application and some difficulties, and it had to do with, in a few cases, stepping on the Constitution just a tad. Minor violations there. With co-petitioning, because you have a petitioner, you can't remove legal or physical custody. That stays with the petitioner. Well, we've also been really, really getting judges to make sure that they use imminent danger language in petitions where there are removals. And so we would have people put imminent danger language on co-petitions, which forced a judge to remove legal custody. So we would have legal custody being removed from co-petitioners. And then there were some also fears, well, what if she goes back? This way we can take the kids easily. And so we had the education was the answer to that. But that was an example of trying to shift to a new idea and still applying some of the same principles that we had there before. And I think we've gotten that one worked out. Right. There'll be some Supreme Court case ruling soon. I don't know.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the real solutions to that was getting back to the judges and helping them see what the constitutional problems are of trying to remove legal custody from a fit parent who is a co-petitioner, but also some of the other safeguards that can be used. And then the brother judges and the sister judges went back to their judicial community to get the word back.
That's great. See, that's the thing. What I find is when you do a good job around this, when people feel that you understand them and understand their constraints and then offer them something that's within their realm, the word gets around.
and then more and more people. I can't tell you how many times I've done trainings where the supervisors will come to the training and none of the staff who work for them will come, and they'll come up to me afterwards and they'll say, okay, so when are you going to be back? Because now that I've seen you, I can send my staff.
Right.
You know, like they don't want their staff to come if it's going to be, like they want to monitor what it is that you're going to do. And then once you do, then next time you go, you've got a lot more people.
Right.
And then people are asking you to come and do, you know, this and do that. And, I mean, it really makes a big difference when you do it well and you help people to feel that you understand or are willing to hear what their challenges are and work within those to come up with other solutions.
Right.
So I'm wondering if it's a good time, because we've got, I think, about 20 minutes left. If it's a good time to shift then to that idea of, so a coping mechanism that people will use when they're experiencing a lot of trauma is accommodation, and there's and dissociation, and there's a number of other ones. So is this a good time for me to talk a little bit about that?
I think that'd be great, Olga, yeah.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll spend a few minutes, I'm going to frame it first from a trauma standpoint and then talk more specifically about things to look for. Like, how would you assess that kind of that for mothers and their children? And then hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for what services would help. And I'm going to talk about this from the perspective of someone who has experienced trauma and coped this way. And also from the perspective of having seen my mom experience trauma and cope in a very similar manner. So just to get everybody on the same page, everybody knows that that when you experience trauma, so when you're faced with a life-threatening situation or a situation that may cause serious bodily harm, And that's relative. It's always relative to the individual. So one person might see an event as traumatic, and another person who went through the same event may not see it as traumatic. So it's all relative. Which is a really important thing to remember. So I may, as someone who grew up in a home being drawn into domestic violence between that my father was perpetrating on my mother, and then also being a victim of sexual abuse that my father perpetrated on me and then engaged my brothers in, I am more likely to see something, to be triggered and have a traumatic response than someone who didn't grow up in a home like that. And it's also possible that other things that someone else might find traumatic, because of the coping mechanisms that I developed, I may not find traumatic, like, being in a car accident won't be as traumatic for me as it might be for someone who hasn't experienced any sort of trauma. So the key is, really what I'm trying to say, is that you have to listen to the person that you're talking to or the person that you're working with to look for signs of trauma, to understand whether it's there or not. That you can't assume that because another person who, let's say two people in the same car, who one person thought, it, you know, didn't experience any trauma responses, that the other person shouldn't experience trauma, because it's very, very relative and very individual. So in growing up in this home with trauma, what I did to survive, So the trauma was my father on a daily basis perpetrating physical violence against my mother, emotional abuse against my mother, sexual violence against my mother, and psychological abuse against my mother. And there were lots of purposes for all of this, but the main goal that my father had was he was going to intimidate my mother and the rest of us to do what he wanted when he wanted. He wanted control of our home, and he got it. And he deliberately attacked my mom in ways that she saw herself, in ways that she derived value for herself. So my mother, a traditional Latina woman who grew up believing that being married and having children and taking good care of your family were really important, my father attacked her ability to cook, attacked her ability to clean, and her relationship with us. And so we were drawn in very much into his attacks against my mom. And more often physically attacked in front of my mother in order to abuse my mother. And I was often sexually attacked by my father in front of my mother. And if my mom tried to stop my father from either from sexually abusing me or physically abusing any of us, my father would make it worse. So these were the things that that we witnessed in our home and experienced in our homes were very traumatic events. And so so the kind of help that there was for us was coping mechanisms that we developed internally and community members who didn't talk about what was happening but connected with us and helped us to counter some of that stuff in our heads. But in our home, when those things were happening, it was so traumatic that at a point when I would feel overpowered or overwhelmed by what was happening. So for example, my first memory of my father attacking me and sexually and raping me was when I was 3 years old. So at that age, I fought back, and then at the point that he overpowered me, and I knew what was going to happen, I dissociated. So I left my body cognitively. I went up to the ceiling and watched as if it happened to someone else. And then I got, after it was over, I was in a dissociative state, and so I wasn't watching myself do this, but I was in a daze, and I cleaned myself up, and I went to bed. And the next morning, I woke up, and I had no, I'd stored that piece of information, that incident, in an imaginary drawer in my head, and I closed that drawer, and when I woke up, I had no access to any of that information. So over time, and that was a really important coping mechanism, the dissociation. Over time, the dissociation was then accompanied by accommodation. So because I learned over time, and so did my mother, that if she fought my father, or if I fought my father, that my attack would be more painful and would last longer. So over time, I learned to accommodate the attack, to accommodate the abuse. So when my father would come into my room, I knew that I was going to be sexually abused, and I made it easy for him. And then over time, when there was a situation that would match a time when I would be abused, I would panic. So, for example, if it was at night and I was trying to go to sleep, or I woke up in the middle of the night startled, and I was waiting anxious, and my anxiety kept rising, because if I woke up in the middle of the night, that was usually a match for when my father was going to come in and sexually abuse me. So if I woke up in the middle of the night, my anxiety would increase and increase and increase until I would reach a point of panic. And at that point, a drawer would open in my head that would show me how to survive this situation. And how to survive the situation was the sexual abuse that my father perpetrated on me. So I went, found my father, and initiated that abuse.
So my father, so in a survival mode, in order to keep my sanity, in order to control the situation, I went to my father and started the and initiated that sexual abuse, not because I was interested in having sexual contact with my father, not because it was about sex at all, but because it was the only way I could take control and stop that panic. And so my father would say it was my fault. I made him do these things to me. I was an evil person. I was going to go to hell. My father would say that all these things were a result of me making him do these things to me. Anyone who works with kids, who deals with child sexual abuse on a regular basis, knows that that's not true. That a child of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever age, does not seduce their parent, is not interested in sex. That's not what's going on. That's usually an indication that this child has been sexually abused over a period of time, and this is a traumatic response to it. And this is a coping mechanism and a survival technique. So when you're hearing that the child, I'll do a lot of trainings for child welfare and for other folks that work with children, and I'll get questions like, well, we placed a child in foster care, and the child is is acting promiscuously with the foster father or one of the brothers. And to me, that's an indication very clearly that that coping mechanism is playing itself out, that coping mechanism of either initiation and or accommodation is playing itself out again. And so there's ways that you can kind of identify that. And parents do the same thing. Like my mom knew, my father never had to say that he would kill us. My mom knew that he would if she tried to leave. And my mom could not tolerate the abuse that she was seeing perpetrated on my brothers and myself. My mom could not tolerate the level of abuse that was being perpetrated against her. And she had a real clear sense that if she left, that she would be killed. So the only escape that my mother had was going inside herself. So again, my mom dissociated for much of the time, and my mom accommodated a lot of the abuse. That is, that she accommodated the abuse that happened to her, and my mom ultimately accommodated the abuse that happened to us. Now, she didn't engage in the abuse, but she was unable to stop my father. So if my mom today was in West Virginia, and we were called in by our next door neighbor who lived in a duplex, where her house was attached to ours, so she could hear what was going on. If they called Protective Services and they came out and found evidence, and these are all really big ifs, but found evidence that I was being sexually abused and that my mom wasn't stopping it, then to be able to figure out whether my mom was a victim or not, they would find that out by talking to me, by talking to my brothers, and hopefully by talking to my mom. They would find that out by talking to my neighbors, by talking to my teachers, by talking to the woman who ran the community center behind her house, because they all knew that at some level my father was perpetrating violence against all of us in our home. My next-door neighbor knew the best, because they saw us on a regular basis, and they saw my mom on a regular basis. And my father wasn't always smart to hide the abuse that he was perpetrating. But so if they were called in, there's a couple things that they could look for. One is they're going to find out that my father had perpetrated violence against my mother. then in talking to my mom, they would, in talking about this abuse, they would need to look for dissociation. Because if my mom had to face what was happening to us, she would have had very flat affect. She would have talked about what was happening probably in a slow manner, or flat affect in a slow manner, or hysterical and all over the place. So I know those two things sound very, very different, but the hysterical and all over the place is also a trauma response. Because when you've experienced trauma, it's really, really hard to talk in a linear manner about that trauma, and oftentimes very hard, depending on how extreme the trauma is, to talk in a linear manner, period. So, but when someone is talking about what has happened to them and they're all over the place, that is typically a sign of trauma. And so you want to look for whether the person looks spaced out, and that's an indication that there might be dissociation. So then you need to look at, so what kinds of things did this mother do, and what was behind that? And in talking to the children, you'll hear, like, I knew the kinds of things that my mother did that were protective of me. Without talking to her, I knew it. And then there were things that my mother did that broke my heart, but I knew that she was doing it because there was no other choice. So that my mom could not stop my father from sexually attacking me. And my mom, after a while, stopped trying to stop my father. And as much as that was very painful for me to see, I also knew that my mom was coping in a manner very similar to mine, because I could see her dissociate and I could see her get numb, and in the same way that I could feel myself doing that. And so if you look for dissociation when you're talking to non-offending mothers, then that's an indication that there's trauma there. And then if you talk to them and they're able to say what it is that transpired, and you check with the children about what happened, you can piece together whether something was abuse or accommodation. And it is pretty easy to tell the difference between them, because when someone is in that dissociative state and they're talking about something that happened, you can see that it's dissociative. You can see that it's flat. You can see that it's like they're not there. And there's a lot of shame that comes up with that, where when someone is talking about abuse that has come up, it's almost always blamed on the target of the abuse. So the child is almost always blamed for it, as opposed to something that they have done to protect that child. I'm not sure if that makes sense. So I want to stop here and just see if what I've kind of laid out helps. So are there any questions or comments?
Okay, yes, we do have a caller from Eugene, Oregon. Your line is open.
Okay, Eugene.
Oh, well, that's been on there for a long time, and we got our question answered a long time ago. It was about prosecutors.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Excuse me.
That's all right, Stephanie.
And next we do have a caller, which is a follow-up from Poposa Springs, Colorado. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, Olga. What is the training video I guess I can ask Joyce Sue, what is the training video you all were referring to of Olga's that you use with child protection workers?
So I have a video where, Joyce, I'll just jump in and say what it is. I have a video that I developed that's about my experience. It's called The Survivor Story. And it's four segments. The first segment's on childhood abuse. The second, witnessing the abuse. The second segment is on the abuse that I suffered as a child, And I do talk about, in that segment, Joyce, the coping mechanisms, right?
Right.
Okay, and then the third segment is adolescence, and I take the coping mechanisms that I developed as a child and show you how that plays out for me as an adolescent for re-victimization. And then the last segment is the healing process, where I talk about dissociation and how I had to learn not to dissociate, and a little bit about that process. So the segments that you guys use, is that segment two, or?
We actually use one and two because, one, you talk a lot about the child protection response in it. I'd love to use the whole thing, but we only have a one-day training. I've actually used it, the whole thing, in other places, but for the child protection system, we use the first two.
And I can tell you, this is Kathy again, that particularly the second part about the coping mechanisms and the accommodation and that sort of thing, you know, it really is an important tool. It's a wonderful gift that you've given us, Olga, because CPS gets it. When they see that, they really get it. They understand what the concept is.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, in the training where we're talking about the definition of knowingly allowing, and we use those first two segments, I asked the group, do you think that Olga's mom knowingly allowed? Well, first of all, I asked them, what is the threat that she was under? And they all agree it was death. And so our definition says, do you think that she knowingly allowed the abuse considering the threat that she was under, which was death? And no one said that she knowingly allowed.
That's amazing because, you know, I'll ask when I do these presentations how many people would have removed me. And then I'll talk about the impact that removal would have had. So and I'm noticing that we're just about out of time. So, Stephanie, was there anybody else on queue?
At this time, I see no additional guests in queue.
Okay. So then let's summarize. You guys do travel and present on what you've done in West Virginia. Is that right?
Yes.
And
we have begun.
And so if any of the people who are on our call would like to bring you in, they can just email you. Is that the situation?
Yeah, that would probably be
that. That'd be great.
And I can be contacted by phone at my coalition office as well.
Okay, and so do you want to give that phone number, Joyce?
304-965-3552. However, email is best.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and then, and so anyone who wants to see the training materials, the materials that you got in your handouts are the materials that are the charts showing the options that that child welfare workers have under this new process, the law, is that right?
Yes.
And policy changes as well?
No, I did not include policy changes or the rules, although those are available if people would like them.
Okay. And then if anyone's interested in purchasing my video, A Survivor's Story, you can find a form to do that on my website, which is ortsolutions.org, and it's in English and Spanish. And if you want more information about what West Virginia is doing, to contact Joyce, right?
Yeah, that would be good.
Okay.
Joyce is always in contact with me.
Okay, that's great. And then one last thing, a really, really good tool for those of you who want to go, who are either in here already, kind of where you guys are in West Virginia, is the Domestic Violence Mental Health Policy Institute. And Joyce, have you guys used them?
Yeah, we have a mental health initiative as well, and they've used them.
Okay. Just because I know that Sue is on their advisory board, or their steering committee. So I figured you guys would have them in. But there, you can get information about trauma and about more information about trauma and some information about dissociation from them. And they're at www.dvmhpi.org, and that's the initials for Domestic Violence Mental Health Policy Institute.org. Okay, so any last comments from Joyce or from Kathy?
No. No, I think this has certainly been a great opportunity and a good experience for us.
Thank you all very much. And if you have any other questions on trauma or anything else, you can feel free to email me at olga@ortsolutions.org. So, Liz, is there anything that you need to do at this point?
No, just thank you very much, the three of you, Kathy and Joyce, for providing us such an important model and sharing your experiences with all of us. It lends a lot of hope, I think, for the rest of the country to catch up with you, so thank you very much. And Olga, as always, thanks for facilitating and making the connections from West Virginia, the work that they've done to your experiences. And just a quick reminder, all of you, we always appreciate getting your feedback, so if you have a minute to return your evaluation, we'd be grateful.
Yeah,
thank you.
Love the feedback. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Kathy and Joyce and Olga, thank you, everybody, so much. And we'll talk with you again.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Great work. Bye, everybody. You guys.